idea who was taking it, who was defending it, or who had the upper hand. They drove on the back roads to avoid the chaos of refugees. They saw farmhouses burning, and then they came across a dozen or so dead English soldiers in the road. They had to get out and drag the men aside to avoid running over them. But a couple of the bodies were almost cut in half. It must have been a big machine gun attack, perhaps from the air, perhaps an ambush. Back in the lorry, Henri was sick in the cab, and Jean-Marie, who was at the wheel, got into a panic and drove into a ditch. They walked to a village, borrowed two horses from a farmer, and pulled the Renault free. That took 2 hours. On the road again, they saw burned-out tanks and armoured cars, German as well as British and French. But they saw no soldiers. The battle had moved on. By the time they reached the hamlet, it was late afternoon. The place had been completely destroyed and was deserted. Their cousin's house was smashed up with bullet holes all over the walls, but it still had its roof. They went in every room and were relieved to find no one there. She must have taken the children and joined the thousands of people on the roads. Afraid of driving back at night, they parked in a wood and tried to sleep in the cab. All night long, they heard the artillery pounding Arras. It seemed impossible that anyone or anything could survive there. They drove back by another route, a much greater distance, to avoid passing the dead soldiers. Now, Henri explained, he and his brother were very tired. When they shut their eyes, they saw those mutilated bodies. Jean-Marie refilled the glasses. The account, with Turner's running translation, had taken almost an hour. All the food was eaten. He thought about telling them of his own single haunting detail. But he didn't want to add to the horror, nor did he want to give life to the image while it remained at a distance, held there by wine and companionship. Instead, he told them how he was separated from his unit at the beginning of the retreat during a Stuka attack. He didn't mention his injury because he didn't want the corporals to know about it. Instead, he explained how they were walking cross-country to Dunkirk to avoid the air raids along the main roads. Jean-Marie said, "So it's true what they're saying. You're leaving." "We'll be back." He said this, but he didn't believe it. The wine was taking hold of Corporal Nettle. He began a rambling eulogy of what he called frog crumpet. How plentiful, how available, how delicious. It was all fantasy. The brothers looked at Turner. "He says French women are the most beautiful in the world." They nodded solemnly and raised their glasses. They were all silent for a while. Their evening was almost at an end. They listened to the night sounds they had grown used to, the rumble of artillery, stray shots in the distance, a booming far-off explosion, probably sappers blowing a bridge in the retreat. "Ask them about their mum," Corporal May suggested. "Let's get that one cleared up." "We were three brothers," Henri explained. "The eldest, Paul, her firstborn, died near Verdun in 1915, a direct hit from a shell. There was nothing to bury apart from his helmet. Us two, we were lucky. We came through without a scratch. Since then, she's always hated soldiers. But now she's 83 and losing her mind. It's an obsession with her. French, English, Belgian, German. She makes no distinction. You're all the same to her. We worry that when the Germans come, she'll go at them with a pitchfork and they'll shoot her." Wearily, the brothers got to their feet. The soldiers did the same. Jean-Marie said, "We would offer you hospitality at our kitchen table, but to do that, we would have to lock her in her room." "But this has been a magnificent feast," Turner said. Nettle was whispering in Mace's ear, and he was nodding. Nettle took from his bag 2 cartons of cigarettes. Of course it was the right thing to do. The Frenchman made a polite show of refusing, but Nettle came round the table and shoved the gifts into their arms. He wanted Turner to translate.
"You should have seen it when the order came through to destroy the stores. 20,000 cigarettes. We took whatever we wanted."
A whole army was fleeing to the coast, armed with cigarettes to keep the hunger away. The Frenchman gave courteous thanks, complimented Turner on his French, then bent over the table to pack the empty bottles and glasses into the canvas bag. There was no pretending that they would meet again.
"We'll be gone at first light," Turner said. "So we'll say goodbye."
They shook hands. Henri Bonnet said, "All that fighting we did 25 years ago, all those dead. Now the Germans back in France. In 2 days they'll be here taking everything we have." Who would have believed it? Turner felt for the first time the full ignominy of the retreat. He was ashamed. He said with even less conviction than before, "We'll be back to throw them out, I promise you." The brothers nodded, and with final smiles of farewell left the dim circle of the candle's glow and crossed the darkness toward the open barn door, the glasses chinking against the bottles as they went. For a long time he lay on his back smoking, staring into the blackness of the cavernous roof. The corporal's snores rose and fell in counterpoint. He was exhausted, but not sleepy. The wound throbbed uncomfortably, each beat precise and tight. Whatever was in there was sharp and close to the surface, and he wanted to touch it with a fingertip. Exhaustion made him vulnerable to the thoughts he wanted least. He was thinking about the French boy asleep in his bed, and about the indifference with which men could lob shells into a landscape, or empty their bomb bays over a sleeping cottage by a railway without knowing or caring who was there. It was an industrial process. He had seen their own RA units at work, tightly knit groups working all hours, proud of the speed with which they could set up a line, and proud of their discipline, drills, training, teamwork. They need never see the end result. A vanished boy. Vanished. As he formed the word in his thoughts, sleep snatched him under, but only for seconds. Then he was awake, on his bed, on his back, staring at the darkness in his cell. He could feel he was back there. He could smell the concrete floor and the piss in the bucket, and the gloss paint on the walls, and hear the snores of the men along the row. 3.5 years of nights like these, unable to sleep, thinking of another vanished boy, another vanished life that was once his own, and waiting for dawn, and slop out, and another wasted day. He did not know how he survived the daily stupidity of it, the stupidity and claustrophobia. The hands squeezing on his throat, being here, sheltering in a barn with an army en route, where a child's limb in a tree was something that ordinary men could ignore, where a whole country, a whole civilization was about to fall, was better than being there, on a narrow bed, under a dim electric light, waiting for nothing. Here there were wooded valleys, streams, sunlight on the poplars, which they could not take away unless they killed him. And there was hope. "I'll wait for you. Come back." There was a chance, just a chance of getting back. He had her last letter in his pocket and her new address. This was why he had to survive and use his cunning to stay off the main roads where the circling dive bombers waited like raptors. Later, He got up from under his greatcoat, pulled on his boots, and groped his way through the barn to relieve himself outside. He was dizzy with fatigue, but he was still not ready for sleep. Ignoring the snarling farm dogs, he found his way along a track to a grassy rise to watch the flashes in the southern sky. This was the approaching storm of German armour. He touched his top pocket, where the poem she sent was enfolded in her letter. In the nightmare of the dark, all the dogs of Europe bark. The rest of her letters were buttoned into the inside pocket of his greatcoat. By standing on the wheel of an abandoned trailer, he was able to see other parts of the sky. The gun flashes were everywhere but the north. The defeated army was running up a corridor that was bound to narrow and soon must be cut off. There would be no chance of escape for the stragglers. At best, it would be prison again. Prison camp. This time, he wouldn't last. When France fell, there would be no end of the war in sight. No letters from her, and no way back. No bargaining and early release in return for joining the infantry. The hand on his throat again. The prospect would be of a thousand or thousands of incarcerated knights sleeplessly turning over the past, waiting for his life to resume, wondering if it ever would. Perhaps it would make sense to leave now before it was too late and keep going all night, all day until he reached the channel. Slip away, leave the corporals to their fate. He turned and began to make his way back down the slope and thought better of it. He could barely see the ground in front of him. He would make no progress in the dark and could easily break a leg. And perhaps the corporals weren't such complete dolts. Mace with his straw mattresses, Nettle with his gift for the brothers. Guided by their snores, he shuffled back to his bed. But still sleep would not come, or came only in quick plunges from which he emerged giddy with thoughts he could not choose or direct. They pursued him, the old themes. Here it was again, his only meeting with her. 6 days out of prison, one day before he reported for duty near Aldershot. When they arranged to meet at Joe Lyon's tea house in the Strand in 1939, they had not seen each other for 3.5 years. He was at the cafe early and took a corner seat with a view of the door. Freedom was still a novelty. The pace and clatter, the colours of coats, jackets and skirts, the bright, loud conversations of West End shoppers, the friendliness of the girl who served him, the spacious lack of threat. He sat back and enjoyed the embrace of the everyday. It had a beauty he alone could appreciate. During his time inside, the only female visitor he was permitted was his mother. In case he was inflamed, they said. Cecilia wrote every week. In love with her, willing himself to stay sane for her, he was naturally in love with her words. When he wrote back, he pretended to be his old self. He lied his way into sanity. For fear of his psychiatrist, who was also their censor, they could never be sensual or even emotional. His was considered a modern, enlightened prison, despite its Victorian chill. He had been diagnosed, with clinical precision, as morbidly oversexed and in need of help as well as correction. He was not to be stimulated. Some letters, both his and hers, were confiscated for some timid expression of affection. So they wrote about literature and used characters as codes. At Cambridge, they had passed each other by in the street. All those books, those happy or tragic couples they had never met to discuss. Tristan and Isolde, the Duke Orsino and Olivia, and Malvolio too. Troilus and Cressida, Mr. Knightley and Emma, Venus and Adonis. Turner and Tallis. Once, in despair, he referred to Prometheus chained to a rock, his liver devoured daily by a vulture. Sometimes she was patient Griselda. Mention of a quiet corner in a library was a code for sexual ecstasy. They charted the daily round, too, in boring, loving detail. He described the prison routine in every aspect, but he never told her of its stupidity. That was plain enough. He never told her that he feared he might go under. That, too, was clear. She never wrote that she loved him, though she would have if she thought it would get through. But he knew it. She told him she had cut herself off from her family. She would never speak to her parents, brother or sister again. He followed closely all her steps along the way toward her nurse's qualification. When she wrote, "I went to the library today to get the anatomy book I told you about. I found a quiet corner and pretended to read." He knew she was feeding on the same memories that consumed him every night beneath thin prison blankets. When she entered the cafe wearing her nurse's cape, startling him from a pleasant daze, he stood too quickly and knocked his tea. He was conscious of the oversized suit his mother had saved for. The jacket did not seem to touch his shoulders at any point. They sat down, looked at each other, smiled and looked away. Robbie and Cecilia had been making love for years, by post. In their coded exchanges, they had drawn close. But how artificial that closeness seemed now, as they embarked on their small talk, their helpless catechism of polite query and response. As the distance opened up between them, they understood how far they had run ahead of themselves in their letters. This moment had been imagined and desired for too long and could not measure up. He had been out of the world and lacked the confidence to step back and reach for the larger thought. "I love you, and you saved my life." He asked about her lodgings. She told him. "And do you get along all right with your landlady?" He could think of nothing better, and feared the silence that might come down, and the awkwardness that would be a prelude to her telling him that it had been nice to meet up again. Now she must be getting back to work. Everything they had rested on a few minutes in a library years ago. Was it too frail? She could easily slip back into being a kind of sister. Was she disappointed? He had lost weight. He had shrunk in every sense. Prison made him despise himself, while she looked as adorable as he remembered her, especially in a nurse's uniform. But she was miserably nervous too, incapable of stepping around the inanities. Instead, she was trying to be light-hearted about her landlady's temper. After a few more such exchanges, she really was looking at the little watch that hung above her left breast and telling him that her lunch break would soon be over. They had had half an hour. He walked with her to Whitehall toward the bus stop. In the precious final minutes, he wrote out his address for her, a bleak sequence of acronyms and numbers. He explained that he would have no leave until his basic training was over. After that, he was granted 2 weeks. She was looking at him, shaking her head in some exasperation, and then at last he took her hand and squeezed. The gesture had to carry all that had not been said, and she answered it with pressure from her own hand. Her bus came, and she did not let go. They were standing face to face. He kissed her, lightly at first, but they drew closer, and when their tongues touched, a disembodied part of himself was abjectly grateful, for he knew he now had a memory in the bank and would be drawing on it for months to come. He was drawing on it now in a French barn, in the small hours. They tightened their embrace and went on kissing while people edged past them in the queue. Some card squawked in his ear. She was crying onto his cheek, and her sorrow stretched her lips against his. Another bus arrived. She pulled away, squeezed his wrist, and got on without a word, and didn't look back. He watched her find her seat, and as the bus began to move, realized he should have gone with her all the way to the hospital. He had thrown away minutes in her company. He must learn again how to think and act for himself. He began to run along Whitehall, hoping to catch up with her at the next stop. But her bus was far ahead, and soon disappearing toward Parliament Square. Throughout his training, they continued to write. Liberated from censorship and the need to be inventive, they proceeded cautiously. Impatient with living on the page, mindful of the difficulties, they were wary of getting ahead of the touch of hands and a single bus stop kiss. They said they loved each other, used darling and dearest, and knew their future was together, but they held back from wilder intimacies. Their business now was to remain connected until those 2 weeks. Through a Girton friend, she found a cottage in Wiltshire they could borrow, and though they thought of little else in their moments of free time, they tried not to dream it away in their letters. Instead, they spoke of their routines. She was now on the maternity ward, and every day brought commonplace miracles, as well as moments of drama or hilarity. There were tragedies, too, against which their own troubles faded to nothing. Stillborn babies, mothers who died, young men weeping in the corridors, dazed mothers in their teens discarded by their families, infant deformities that evoked shame and love in confusing measure. When she described a happy outcome, that moment when the battle was over and an exhausted mother took the child in her arms for the first time and gazed in rapture into a new face, it was the unspoken call to Cecilia's own future, the one she would share with him, which gave the writing its simple power, though in truth his thoughts dwelled less on birth than conception. He in turn described the parade ground, the rifle range, the drills, the bull, the barracks. He was not eligible for officer training, which was as well, for sooner or later he would have met someone in an officer's mess who knew about his past. In the ranks, he was anonymous, and it turned out that to have been inside conferred a certain status. He discovered he was already well adapted to an army regime, to the terrors of kit inspection and the folding of blankets into precise squares with the labels lined up. Unlike his fellows, he thought the food not bad at all. The days, though tiring, seemed rich in variety. The cross-country marches gave him a pleasure that he dared not express to the other recruits. He was gaining in weight and strength. His education and age marked him down, but his past made up for that, and no one gave him trouble. Instead, he was regarded as a wise old bird who knew the ways of them, and who was handy when it came to filling out a form. Like her, he confined his letters to the daily round, interrupted by the funny or alarming anecdote, the recruit who came on parade with a boot missing, the sheep that ran amuck in the barracks and could not be chased out, the sergeant instructor almost hit by a bullet on the range. But there was one external development, one shadow that he had to refer to. After Munich last year, he was certain, like everyone else, that there would be a war. Their training was being streamlined and accelerated. A new camp was being enlarged to take more recruits. His anxiety was not for the fighting he might have to do, but the threat to their Wiltshire dream. She mirrored his fears with descriptions of contingency arrangements at the hospital, more beds, special courses, emergency drills. But for both of them, there was also something fantastical about it all, remote, even though likely. "Surely not again," was what many people were saying. And so they continued to cling to their hopes. There was another closer matter that troubled him. Cecilia had not spoken to her parents, brother or sister, since November 1935, when Robbie was sentenced. She would not write to them, nor would she let them know her address. Letters reached her through his mother, who had sold the bungalow and moved to another village. It was through Grace that she let her family know she was well and did not wish to be contacted. Leon had come to the hospital once, but she would not speak to him. He waited outside the gates all afternoon. When she saw him, she retreated inside until he went away. The following morning, he was outside the nurse's hostel. She pushed past him and would not even look in his direction. He took her elbow, but she wrenched her arm free and walked on, outwardly unmoved by his pleading. Robbie knew better than anyone how she loved her brother, how close she was to her family, and how much the house and the park meant to her. He could never return, but it troubled him to think that she was destroying a part of herself for his sake. A month into his training, he told her what was on his mind. It wasn't the first time that they had been through this, but the issue had become clearer. She wrote in reply, "They turned on you, all of them, even my father. When they wrecked your life, they wrecked mine. They chose to believe the evidence of a silly, hysterical little girl. In fact, they encouraged her by giving her no room to turn back. She was a young 13, I know, but I never want to speak to her again. As for the rest of them, I can never forgive what they did. Now that I've broken away, I'm beginning to understand the snobbery that lay behind their stupidity. My mother never forgave you, your first. My father preferred to lose himself in his work. Leon turned out to be a grinning, spineless idiot who went along with everyone else. When Hardman decided to cover for Danny, no one in my family wanted the police to ask him the obvious questions. The police had you to prosecute. They didn't want their case messed up. I know I sound bitter, but my darling, I don't want to be. I'm honestly happy with my new life and my new friends. I feel I can breathe now. Most of all, I have you to live for. Realistically, there had to be a choice, you or them. How could it be both? I've never had a moment's doubt. I love you. I believe in you completely. You are my dearest one, my reason for life. C." He knew these last lines by heart and mouthed them now in the darkness. "My reason for life. Not living, but life." That was the touch. And she was his reason for life and why he must survive. He lay on his side, staring at where he thought the barn's entrance was, waiting for the first signs of light. He was too restless for sleep now. He wanted only to be walking to the coast. There was no cottage in Wiltshire for them. 3 weeks before his training ended, war was declared. The military response was automatic, like the reflexes of a clam. All leave was cancelled. Sometime later, it was redefined as postponed. A date was given, changed, cancelled. Then, with 24 hours' notice, railway passes were issued. They had 4 days before reporting back for duty with their new regiment. The rumour was they would be on the move. She had tried to rearrange her holiday dates and partly succeeded. When she tried again, she could not be accommodated. By the time his card arrived, telling her of his arrival, she was on her way to Liverpool for a course in severe trauma nursing at the Alder Hey Hospital. The day after he reached London, he set out to follow her north, but the trains were impossibly slow. Priority was for military traffic moving southward. At Birmingham New Street Station, he missed a connection, and the next train was cancelled. He would have to wait until the following morning. He paced the platforms for half an hour in a turmoil of indecision. Finally, he chose to turn back. Reporting late for duty was a serious matter. By the time she returned from Liverpool, he was disembarking at Cherbourg, and the dullest winter of his life lay before him. The distress, of course, was shared between them, but she felt it her duty to be positive and soothing. "I'm not going to go away," she wrote in her first letter after Liverpool. "I'll wait for you. Come back." She was quoting herself. She knew he would remember. From that time on, this was how she ended every one of her letters to Robbie and France, right through to the last, which arrived just before the order came to fall back on Dunkirk. It was a long, bitter winter for the British Expeditionary Force in northern France. Nothing much happened. They dug trenches, secured supply lines, and were sent out on night exercises that were farcical for the infantrymen, because the purpose was never explained and there was a shortage of weapons. Off duty, every man was a general. Even the lowliest private soldier had decided that the war would not be fought in the trenches again. But the anti-tank weapons that were expected never arrived. In fact, they had little heavy weaponry at all. It was a time of boredom and football matches against other units, and day-long marches along country roads with full pack, and nothing to do for hours on end but to keep in step and daydream to the beat of boots on asphalt. He would lose himself in thoughts of her and plan his next letter, refining the phrases, trying to find comedy in the dullness. It may have been the first touches of green along the French lanes and the haze of bluebells glimpsed through the woods that made him feel the need for reconciliation and fresh beginnings. He decided he should try again to persuade her to make contact with her parents. She needn't forgive them or go back over the old arguments. She should just write a short and simple letter, letting them know where and how she was. Who could tell what changes might follow over the years to come? He knew that if she did not make her peace with her parents before one of them died, her remorse would be endless. He would never forgive himself if he did not encourage her. So he wrote in April, and her reply did not reach him until mid-May, when they were already falling back through their own lines, not long before the order came to retreat all the way to the Channel. There had been no contact with enemy fire. The letter was in his top pocket now. It was her last to reach him before the post-delivery system broke down. "I wasn't going to tell you about this now. I still don't know what to think, and I wanted to wait until we're together. Now I have your letter, it doesn't make sense not to tell you. The first surprise is that Bryony isn't at Cambridge. She didn't go up last autumn. She didn't take her place. I was amazed because I'd heard from Dr. Hall that she was expected. The other surprise is that she's doing nurses' training at my old hospital. Can you imagine Bryony with a bedpan? I suppose they all said the same thing about me. But she's such a fantasist, as we know to our cost. I pity the patient who receives an injection from her. Her letter is confused and confusing. She wants to meet. She's beginning to get the full grasp of what she did and what it has meant. Clearly not going up has something to do with it. She's saying that she wants to be useful in a practical way. But I get the impression she's taken on nursing as a sort of penance. She wants to come and see me and talk. I might have this wrong, and that's why I was going to wait and go through this with you face to face. But I think she wants to recant. I think she wants to change her evidence and do it officially or legally. This might not even be possible given that your appeal was dismissed. We need to know more about the law. Perhaps I should see a solicitor. I don't want us to get our hopes up for nothing. She might not mean what I think she does, or she might not be prepared to see it through. Remember what a dreamer she is. I'll do nothing until I've heard from you. I wouldn't have told you any of this, but when you wrote to tell me again that I should be in touch with my parents, I admire your generous spirit. I had to let you know because the situation could change. If it's not legally possible for Bryony to go before a judge and tell him she's had second thoughts, then she can at least go and tell our parents. Then they can decide what they want to do. If they can bring themselves to write a proper apology to you, then perhaps we may have the beginning of a new start. I keep thinking of her. To go into nursing, to cut herself off from her background, is a bigger step for her than it was for me. I had my 3 years at Cambridge, at least, and I had an obvious reason to reject my family. She must have her reasons, too. I can't deny that I'm curious to find out. But I'm waiting for you, my darling, to tell me your thoughts. Yes, and by the way, she also said she'd had a piece of writing turned down by Cyril Connolly at Horizon. So at least someone can see through her wretched fantasies. Do you remember those premature twins I told you about? The smaller one died. It happened in the night when I was on. The mother took it very badly indeed. We'd heard that the father was a bricklayer's mate, and I suppose we were expecting some cheeky little chap with a fag stuck on his lower lip. He'd been in East Anglia with contractors seconded to the army, building coastal defences, which was why he was so late coming to the hospital. He turned out to be a very handsome fellow, 19 years old, more than 6 feet tall, with blonde hair that flopped over his forehead. He has a club foot like Byron, which was why he hadn't joined up. Jenny said he looked like a Greek god. He was so sweet and gentle and patient, comforting his young wife. We were all touched by it. The saddest part was that he was just getting somewhere, calming her down, when visiting time ended and sister came through and made him leave along with everyone else. That left us to pick up the pieces. Poor girl. But 4 o'clock, and rules are rules. I'm going to rush down with this to the Balham sorting office in the hope that it will be across the channel before the weekend. But I don't want to end on a sad note. I'm actually very excited by this news about my sister and what it could mean for us. I enjoyed your story about the sergeant's latrines. I read that bit to the girls and they laughed like lunatics. I'm so glad the liaison officer has discovered your French and given you a job that makes use of it. Why did they take so long to find out about you? Did you hang back? You're right about French bread. 10 minutes later and you're hungry again. All air and no substance. Balham isn't as bad as I said it was, but more about that next time. I'm enclosing a poem by Auden on the death of Yeats, cut out from an old London Mercury from last year. I'm going down to see Grace at the weekend, and I'll look in the boxes for your houseman. Mustache, you're in my thoughts every minute. I love you. I'll wait for you. Come back. See. He was woken by a boot, nudging the small of his back.
Come on, Governor, rise and shine.
He sat up and looked at his watch. The barn entrance was a rectangle of bluish black. He had been asleep, he reckoned, for less than 45 minutes. Mace diligently emptied the straw from the sacks and dismantled his table. They sat in silence on the hay bales, smoking the first cigarette of the day. When they stepped outside, they found a clay pot with a heavy wooden lid. Inside, wrapped in muslin cloth, was a loaf and a wedge of cheese. Turner divided the provisions right there with a bowie knife. In case we're separated, he murmured. A light was on already in the farmhouse, and the dogs were in a frenzy as they walked away. They climbed a gate and began to cross a field in a northerly direction. After an hour, they stopped in a coppiced wood to drink from their canteens and smoke. Turner studied the map. Already the first bombers were high overhead, a formation of about 50 Heinkels, heading the same way to the coast. The sun was coming up and there was little cloud. A perfect day for the Luftwaffe. They walked in silence for another hour. There was no path, so he made a route by the compass, through fields of cows and sheep, turnips and young wheat. They were not as safe as he thought away from the road. One field of cattle had a dozen shell craters, and fragments of flesh, bone, and brindled skin had been blasted across a 100-yard stretch. But each man was folded into his thoughts, and no one spoke. Turner was troubled by the map. He guessed they were 25 miles from Dunkirk. The closer they came, the harder it would be to stay off the roads. Everything converged. There were rivers and canals to cross. When they headed for the bridges, they would only lose time if they cut away across country again. Just after 10, they stopped for another rest. They had climbed a fence to reach a track, but he could not find it on the map. It ran in the right direction anyway, over flat, almost treeless land. They had gone another half hour when they heard anti-aircraft fire a couple of miles ahead, where they could see the spire of a church. He stopped to consult the map again. Corporal Nettle said, "It don't show Crumpet, that map."
"Shh, he's having his doubts."
Turner leaned his weight against a fence post. His side hurt whenever he put his right foot down. The sharp thing seemed to be protruding and snagging on his shirt. Impossible to resist probing with a forefinger. But he felt only tender, ruptured flesh. After last night, it wasn't right he should have to listen to the corporal's taunts again. Tiredness and pain were making him irritable, but he said nothing and tried to concentrate. He found the village on the map, but not the track, though it surely led there. It was just as he had thought. They would join the road, and they would need to stay on it all the way to the defence line at the Bergfern Canal. There was no other route. The corporal's banter was continuing. He folded the map and walked on.
"What's the plan, Governor?"
He did not reply.
Oh, now you've offended her."
Beyond the Akak, they heard artillery fire, their own, some way further to the west. As they approached the village, they heard the sound of slow-moving lorries. Then they saw them stretching in a line to the north, travelling at walking pace. It was going to be tempting to hitch a ride, but he knew from experience what an easy target they would be from the air. On foot, you could see and hear what was coming. Their track joined the road where it turned a right-angle corner to leave the village. They rested their feet for 10 minutes, sitting on the rim of a stone water trough. 3- and 10-ton lorries, half-tracks and ambulances, were grinding round the narrow turn at less than 1 mile an hour, and moving away from the village down a long straight road whose left side was flanked by plane trees. The road led directly north, toward a black cloud of burning oil that stood above the horizon, marking out Dunkirk. No need for a compass now. Dotted along the way were disabled military vehicles. Nothing was to be left for enemy use. From the backs of receding lorries, the conscious wounded stared out blankly. There were also armoured cars, staff cars, Bren gun carriers, and motorbikes. Mixed in with them, and stuffed or piled high with household gear and suitcases, were civilian cars, buses, farm trucks and carts, pushed by men and women or pulled by horses. The air was grey with diesel fumes, and straggling wearily through the stench, and for the moment moving faster than the traffic, were hundreds of soldiers, most of them carrying their rifles and their awkward greatcoats, a burden in the morning's growing warmth. Walking with the soldiers were families hauling suitcases, bundles, babies, or holding the hands of children. The only human sound Turner heard, piercing the din of engines, was the crying of babies. There were old people walking singly. One old man in a fresh lawn suit, bow tie and carpet slippers shuffled by with the help of two sticks, advancing so slowly that even the traffic was passing him. He was panting hard. Wherever he was going, he surely would not make it. On the far side of the road, right on the corner, was a shoe shop open for business. Turner saw a woman with a little girl at her side talking to a shop assistant who displayed a different shoe in the palm of each hand. The three paid no attention to the procession behind them. Moving against the flow, and now trying to edge round this same corner, was a column of armoured cars, the paintwork untouched by battle, heading south into the German advance. All they could hope to achieve against a panzer division was an extra hour or two for the retreating soldiers. Turner stood up, drank from his canteen, and stepped into the procession, slipping in behind a couple of Highland Light infantrymen. The corporals followed him. He no longer felt responsible for them now they had joined the main body of the retreat. His lack of sleep exaggerated his hostility. Today their teasing needled him and seemed to betray the comradeship of the night before. In fact, he felt hostile to everyone around him. His thoughts had shrunk to the small, hard point of his own survival. Wanting to shake the corporals off, he quickened his pace, overtook the Scotsman, and pushed his way past a group of nuns shepherding a couple of dozen children in blue tunics. They looked like the rump of a boarding school, like the one he had taught at near Lille in the summer before he went up to Cambridge. It seemed another man's life to him now, a dead civilization. First his own life ruined, then everybody else's. He strode on angrily, knowing it was a pace he could not maintain for long. He had been in a column like this before, on the first day, and he knew what he was looking for. To his immediate right was a ditch, but it was shallow and exposed. The line of trees was on the other side. He slipped across in front of a Renault saloon. As he did so, the driver leaned on his horn. The shrill klaxon startled Turner into a sudden fury. Enough! He leaped back to the driver's door and wrenched it open. Inside was a trim little fellow in a grey suit and fedora, with leather suitcases piled at his side and his family jammed in the back seat. Turner grabbed the man by his tie and was ready to smack his stupid face with an open right hand, but another hand, one of some great strength, closed about his wrist. "That ain't the enemy, Governor." Without releasing his grip, Corporal Mace pulled him away. Nettle, who was just behind, kicked the Renault door shut with such ferocity that the wing mirror fell off. The children in blue tunics cheered and clapped. The three crossed to the other side and walked on under the line of trees. The sun was well up now and it was warm, but the shade was not yet over the road. Some of the vehicles lying across the ditches had been shot up in air attacks. Around the abandoned lorries they passed, supplies had been scattered by troops looking for food or drink or petrol. Turner and the corporals tramped through typewriter ribbon spools, spilling from their boxes, double-entry ledgers, consignments of tin desks and swivel chairs, cooking utensils and engine parts, saddles, stirrups and harnesses, sewing machines, football trophy cups, stackable chairs, and a film projector and petrol generator, both of which someone had wrecked with a crowbar that was lying nearby. They passed an ambulance, half in the ditch, with one wheel removed. A brass plaque on the door said, "This ambulance is a gift of the British residents of Brazil." It was possible, Turner found, to fall asleep while walking. The roar of lorry engines would be suddenly cut, then his neck muscles relaxed, his head drooped, and he would wake with a start and a swerve to his step. Nettle and Mace were forgetting a lift. But he had already told them the day before what he had seen in that first column. 20 men in the back of a 3-ton lorry killed with a single bomb. Meanwhile, he had cowered in a ditch with his head in a culvert and caught the shrapnel in his side. "You go ahead," he said. "I'm sticking here." So the matter was dropped. They wouldn't go without him. He was their lucky ticket. They came up behind some more HLI men. One of them was playing the bagpipes, prompting the corporals to begin their own nasal whining parodies. Turner made as if to cross the road. "If you start a fight, I'm not with you." Already a couple of Scots had turned and were muttering to each other. "It's a braw bricht moonlicht nicht, the nicht," Nettle called out in Cockney. Something awkward might have developed then if they had not heard a pistol shot from up ahead. As they drew level, the bagpipes fell silent. In a wide open field, the French cavalry had assembled in force and dismounted to form a long line. At the head stood an officer dispatching each horse with a shot to the head, and then moving on to the next. Each man stood to attention by his mount, holding his cap ceremonially against his chest. The horses patiently waited their turn. This enactment of defeat depressed everyone's spirits further. The corporals had no heart for a tangle with the Scotsmen, who could no longer be bothered with them. Minutes later, they passed 5 bodies in a ditch, 3 women, 2 children. Their suitcases lay around them. One of the women wore carpet slippers, like the man in the lawn suit. Turner looked away, determined not to be drawn in. If he was going to survive, he had to keep a watch on the sky. He was so tired he kept forgetting. And it was hot now. Some men were letting their greatcoats drop to the ground. A glorious day. In another time, this was what would have been called a glorious day. Their road was on a long, slow rise, enough to be a drag on the legs and increase the pain in his side. Each step was a conscious decision. A blister was swelling on his left heel, which forced him to walk on the edge of his boot. Without stopping, he took the bread and cheese from his bag, but he was too thirsty to chew. He lit another cigarette to curb his hunger and tried to reduce his task to the basics. You walked across the land until you came to the sea. What could be simpler once the social element was removed? He was the only man on earth, and his purpose was clear. He was walking across the land until he came to the sea. The reality was all too social, he knew. Other men were pursuing him, but he had comfort in a pretense and a rhythm at least for his feet. He walked across the land until he came to the sea. A hexameter. 5 iams and an anapest was the beat he tramped to now.
This ends Disc 7. Atonement, Disc 8.
Another 20 minutes and the road began to level out. Glancing over his shoulder, he saw the convoy stretching back down the hill for a mile. Ahead, he could not see the end of it. They crossed a railway line. By his map, they were 16 miles from the canal. They were entering a stretch where the wrecked equipment along the road was more or less continuous. Half a dozen 25-pounder guns were piled beyond the ditch, as if swept up there by a heavy bulldozer. Up ahead, where the land began to drop, there was a junction with a back road and some kind of commotion was taking place. There was laughter from the soldiers on foot and raised voices at the roadside. As he came up, he saw a major from the Buffs, a pink-faced fellow of the old school, in his 40s, shouting and pointing toward a wood that lay about a mile away across 2 fields. He was pulling men out of the column, or trying to. Most ignored him and kept going. Some laughed at him. But a few were intimidated by his rank and had stopped, though he lacked any personal authority. They were gathered around him with their rifles, looking uncertain.
"You!"
"Yes, you, you'll do."
The major's hand was on Turner's shoulder. He stopped and saluted before he knew what he was doing. The corporals were behind him. The major had a little toothbrush moustache overhanging small, tight lips that clipped his words briskly. "We've got Jerry trapped in the woods over there. He must be an advance party, but he's well dug in with a couple of machine guns. We're going to get in there and flush him out."
Turner felt the horror chill and weaken his legs. He showed the major his empty palms.
"What with, sir?"
"With cunning and a bit of teamwork."
How was the fool to be resisted? Turner was too tired to think, though he knew he wasn't going.
"Now I've got the remains of 2 platoons halfway up the eastern..."
Remains.
was the word that told the story and prompted Mace, with all his barrack room skill, to interrupt.
Beg pardon, sir. Permission to speak?
Not granted, Corporal.
Thank you, sir. Orders is from GHQ. Proceed at haste and speed and celerity, without delay, diversion or divagation, to Dunkirk for the purpose of immediate evacuation on account of being horribly and onerously overrun from all directions. Sir.
The Major turned and poked his forefinger into Mace's chest.
Now look here, you. This is our one last chance to show...
Corporal Nettle said dreamily,
"It was Lord Gort what wrote out that order, sir, and sent it down personally."
It seemed extraordinary to Turner that an officer should be addressed this way, and risky too. The Major had not grasped that he was being mocked. He seemed to think that it was Turner who had spoken, for the little speech that followed was addressed to him.
"The retreat is a bloody shambles, for heaven's sake, man. This is your one last good chance to show what we can do when we're decisive and determined. What's more?"
He went on to say a good deal more, but it seemed to Turner that a muffling silence had descended on the bright late morning scene. This time, he wasn't asleep. He was looking past the Major's shoulder toward the head of the column. Hanging there a long way off, about 30 feet above the road, warped by the rising heat, was what looked like a plank of wood, suspended horizontally with a bulge in its centre. The Major's words were not reaching him, and nor were his own clear thoughts. The horizontal apparition hovered in the sky without growing larger, and though he was beginning to understand its meaning, it was, as in a dream, impossible to begin to respond or move his limbs. His only action had been to open his mouth, but he could make no sound and would not have known what to say, even if he could. Then, precisely at the moment when sound flooded back in, he was able to shout,
"Go!"
He began to run directly toward the nearest cover. It was the vaguest, least soldierly form of advice, but he sensed the corporal's not far behind. Dreamlike, too, was the way he could not move his legs fast enough. It was not pain he felt below his ribs, but something scraping against the bone. He let his greatcoat fall. 50 yards ahead was a 3-ton lorry on its side. That black, greasy chassis, that bulbous differential, was his only home. He didn't have long to get there. A fighter was strafing the length of the column. The broad spray of fire was advancing up the road at 200 miles an hour, a rattling hailstorm din of cannon rounds hitting metal and glass. No one inside the near stationary vehicles had started to react. Drivers were only just registering the spectacle through their windscreens. They were where he had been seconds before. Men in the backs of lorries knew nothing. A sergeant stood in the centre of the road and raised his rifle. A woman screamed, and then fire was upon them, just as Turner threw himself into the shadow of the upended lorry. The steel frame trembled as rounds hit it with the wild rapidity of a drum roll. Then the cannon fire swept on, hurtling down the column, chased by the fighter's roar and the flicker of its shadow. He pressed himself into the darkness of the chassis by the front wheel. Never had sump oil smelled sweeter. Waiting for another plane, he crouched fetally, his arms cradling his head and eyes tight shut, and thought only of survival. But nothing came. Only the sounds of insects determined on their late spring business, and birdsong resuming after a decent pause. And then, as if taking their cue from the birds, the wounded began to groan and call out, and terrified children began to cry. Someone, as usual, was cursing the RAF. Turner stood up and was dusting himself down when Nettle and Mace emerged, and together they walked back toward the Major, who was sitting on the ground. All the colour had gone from his face, and he was nursing his right hand.
"Bullet went clean through it," he said as they came up. "Jolly lucky, really."
They helped him to his feet and offered to take him over to an ambulance, where an RAMC captain and two orderlies